The following lecture is under copyright by Reformation Christian Ministries and is for your personal use only. It is not to be copied or otherwise distributed, sold, or used commercially without the specific written permission of Reformation Christian Ministries. Contact information will be provided at the end of this lecture.
This is Modern Church, Lecture 7. We have been looking at deism as a natural result of a rationalistic approach to Christianity, as is found in Arminianism. And we have gone through a number of the deists in England during the latter part of the 17th century and early part of the 18th century. And we now turn to some of the opponents of deism, because, of course, this rationalism, and especially the results of rationalism, did not go unnoticed among those who were more orthodox in their Christian faith. First of all, we'd like to talk about Samuel Clarke, who was a popular philosopher. He was a supernaturalist. He believed, of course, that the Bible's revelation about a God above nature and so on was true. And in fact, he talked about a proof of Christianity based on eternity. Since man can see no beginning or end, we would have to recognize that there is someone or something out there that is eternal, and that would have to be God. He thought, however, that even though revelation was important to our understanding of God, and revelation ought to be believed, he thought that revelation could be supported by reason or defended by reason. So he would have taken what we would call a rationalist approach to apologetics today. Unfortunately, his Christology, and this seems to be a continuing problem among these people, his Christology was not orthodox. He was an Arian in the ancient church sense of not believing that the Son was truly God. He denied that both the Son and the Holy Spirit were of one substance with the Father. And so he believed that they were both creatures, or at least not God in the sense that the Father is God. And so you have, again, a defective kind of Christianity. Another man by the name of William Whiston, who lived in this early part of the 18th century, wrote a booklet called Primitive Christianity Revived. He said, too, that early Christianity was Arian, and he wanted to demonstrate that. He said that the New Testament fulfillment shows that the Old Testament text is corrupted. There are a lot of truths in the Old Testament. Nevertheless, the text is not trustworthy, and we have to be careful what we accept from it. He was a Church of England, an Anglican rector, who believed that the millennium would begin in 1776. For his trouble, he was deposed from the ministry of the Church of England. And we have a more famous man in Joseph Butler, who lived from 1692 to 1725. He was really quite an able defender of Christian orthodoxy. He was a country rector in the Church of England, and he wrote, of course, and is famous for Butler's Analogy, which is a defense of orthodox Christianity and is a defense also of the existence of God. He believed that you could prove God from nature, although nature is no easier to interpret than Scripture. So he didn't believe that everybody would come to the conclusion that in the existence of God. But he certainly recognized that reason cannot be the basis of everything. And he attacked the rationalism of deism as being off base. It simply was not possible to come to all knowledge by rationalism. I don't know that he would have said or would have realize the problem of man's mind being the measure of all things, but he certainly attacked the reason of deism. He said that from a study of nature, from this aspect, we can come to a strong probability for the existence of God, but that with the Scripture we come to an actual commitment to the truth. And so he felt that Scripture was needed in order to really know the truth about God. From him we go to William Paley, who lived from 1743 to 1805. We're now getting to the second half of the 18th century. He was a popular defender of the faith. He wrote a natural theology, a book of natural theology. He also wrote a book called A View of the Evidences of Christianity. He came up with a new form of the design argument, a very direct form of the design argument, that the universe itself demonstrates that it was designed because of its complexity, and yet the great order in which the various elements of the universe fit together cannot be the product of anything but an intelligent design, he argued. He also defended the morality of the New Testament as being at a much higher level than that which we find in nature, where it's pretty much a dog-eat-dog situation. Now, we have to recognize that neither orthodoxy and conservatism nor deism actually swept England at the time, but both of them are currents of thought which are important at the time, and yet which do not become the kind of things that sweep the whole church. It's later on that rationalism becomes a very powerful force all over Europe through the Enlightenment, so-called. We don't think of it as an enlightenment at all. When man turns to himself for truth, he really turns to darkness, because as Jesus Christ says in Luke 16, that which is highly esteemed among men is abomination in the sight of God. And that's certainly true with respect to various currents of thought, whether they're philosophical or moral. Well, I think we need to recognize that by 1750 in England, the opposition was stronger than deism, which I think is interesting when we realize that 100 years later, deism and rationalism had pretty much triumphed. Mr. Paul Woolley, who taught church history at Westminster Seminary, was my professor of church history, thought that all of this came with Arminianism. This rationalism came to England with Arminianism from Holland, and because rationalism has at its basis, Arminianism has at its basis, looking at the question of salvation from the point not of biblical teaching, but from the point of human rationalism, you come to these kinds of conclusions. And so rationalism and deism are simply Arminianism carried to its logical conclusion. And I think that's a very important insight for us to have at this time. Well, let's turn now to a little different kind of church history, not so much the history of thought, but the history of church events. And we'll begin with Scotland, where with all the various theological currents going around, the moderates finally gained control in Scotland. First of all, we're aware of the covenants not to participate in government because of Charles I. Well, after Charles II was reinstated as the monarch of England and Scotland, Charles II was reinstated in 1662. He also reinstated bishops in Scotland. He annulled the actions of the old parliaments, which had taken very careful Protestant and Presbyterian stands, and particularly had taken anti-Anglican stands. He annulled all of those actions by Parliament, and he declared the covenants to be high treason, that which had been very dear to the hearts of the Scottish people and their ministers, he called to be high treason. By November 1st, 1662, you see, he moved rather quickly. All the ministers in Scotland had to be collated, which meant that they had to be installed by one of the new bishops which had been established by the Church of England. Now, most of the Scottish ministers finally bowed to this, but 400 brave men, I think we'd have to say they were certainly brave, walked out. They refused and walked out of the Church of Scotland, because it was now again under the control of the Anglicans from England. Now, they were forced by law not to reside within 20 miles of their former parishes. The idea was that they couldn't preach to the people that they had been pastors of. And another part of that law was that people who did not attend their local parish church could be fined. So neither the ministers could travel to the parishes, nor could the people of the parish travel to hear the ministers preach. By 1669, there was still a great deal of unrest, and so indulgences were offered whereby these outcast pastors could return to the manse and preach, but they could not have a stipend from the government, from the state. Only of the 400, only 40 accepted that olive branch. In 1672, certain pastors were named to be free to return if they did not preach their dissension from the Scottish state church. Now about 50 returned to their pulpits, and thus about one-fourth of the Presbyterian pastors were back in their pulpits by about 10 years after Charles was reinstated. However, the persecution of illegal services became more and more severe. Criminal offenses, it became a criminal offense not to attend your parish service. Attending a covenanter service was considered to be a criminal offense. And if one of five or more strangers, if you were one of five or more strangers at a prayer meeting, that was a criminal offense. For example, if there were a prayer meeting in Parish A, And five strangers or more from Parish B showed up at that prayer meeting, and you happened to be one of them, that was a criminal offense. So the government was doing its absolute best or worst, depending on your perspective here, to cut down on this dissension on the part of the Scottish pastors and their people. Finally, because it wasn't working, martial law was declared. Great numbers of people, great numbers of ministers were arrested, some were exiled, some were imprisoned in bad conditions, and so on. And so Scotland really became a hotbed of violence and dissension as a result of the reinstatement of the monarchy. Well, the Covenanters themselves also sometimes resorted to violence. They differed among themselves about this. There were some of the Covenanters who said, when we are attacked physically, we have a right to defend ourselves, and we have a right to defend our rights as Christians, and so on. And others said, no, we have to practice nonviolence in a matter like this, even when we are arrested and treated very, very badly. Well, in 1679, actually on June 1st, a group of Covenanters was attacked by a small cavalry detachment, and the Covenanters won the battle. Well, this, of course, caused the king's army to gather itself together for more of a battle, and on June 22nd, just a few days later, the Covenanters were routed. Some were hung, some were freed, and 250 of them were sent overseas into exile, but they're shipwrecked, and they were drowned. So the Covenanters were not doing very well. Nevertheless, some very brave and hardy souls arose among the Scottish Covenanters to continue the battle. We think, first of all, of Richard Renwick, who was a Covenanter leader in October 1679. He returned from training and ordination in the Netherlands to become a pastor. But he also became leader of the armed Covenanter opposition and enjoyed some success. In fact, finally, in June of 1680, at San Cahar, they declared war and disowned the king. Unfortunately, within a month or about a month later, Richard Renwick was captured by the government forces and was killed. The last Covenanter preacher, by the way, was killed in 1681, but opposition continued to the state church. Another Renwick, James, returned from Holland in 1683. Now, all Covenanter Protestant activity by that time had become an offense. James II, of course, was by now on the throne, the brother of Charles II, and he was a Roman Catholic. So all kinds of things were done. Women were arrested and tortured in order to keep their husbands and their men in line. And James, of course, pushed the Roman Catholic Church in Scotland now. And there were, of course, some Roman Catholic people, and they took advantage of this. And so the problems just seem to be snowballing, getting worse and worse. And finally, in 1688, James Renwick was captured and hung in Edinburgh. Now, in the grace of God and in the run of history, fortunately, James II's rule in England didn't last too long because he was a Roman Catholic. And not only did the Scottish people resent that tremendously, so did the English people. And as you will remember, the Glorious Revolution, that is the invitation to William II of Orange, who was William III of England, the Dutch king came and invaded England, and he and his English wife were established on the throne of England and Scotland, and William, of course, ended the persecution of Covenanters and of Presbyterians. In fact, William and Mary restored Presbyterian government to Scotland. Unfortunately, nothing was said about the covenants or the repeal of the earlier nullifying act. In other words, William and Mary's hand was somewhat stayed by the power of the Church of England, and they were not able to overcome, even if they wanted to. We don't really know at this point in history if they wished to overthrow. They certainly would have had sympathy with the Covenanters, but nothing was done to repeal the nullifying act of all the covenants. Now, the dissenters from the Church of Scotland were mixed in their reaction on whether to continue as Covenanters or just be Presbyterians and be happy with the peace that they had. Finally, the Covenanters in 1706 You see, that was indeed almost 20 years after William and Mary came to the throne. They were allowed to have a Presbyterian minister and celebrated their first communion in Edinburgh in 22 years. This was not a Presbyterian communion, but a specifically Covenanter Presbyterian communion. In 1743, the Covenanters were allowed to have their first presbytery meeting, setting up the Reformed Presbyterian Church. And, of course, the Reformed Presbyterian Church of Scotland then is the mother church of the Reformed Presbyterian churches in North America, of which there were two. The Old Light Covenanters, who continue to this day, are called the Reformed Presbyterian Church in North America, and they continue to hold to the covenants. The New Lights, the ones who came to the United States and gave up the covenants, just wanting to be regular Presbyterians, were the Reformed Presbyterian Church. I got to trace their history a little bit. They joined with the Evangelical Presbyterian Church, which was an offshoot of the Orthodox Presbyterian breakaway from the United Presbyterian Church, and formed the Reformed Presbyterian Church Evangelical Synod for a while, starting in the 1960s, and ended up in the Presbyterian Church in America by joining and being received. That RPC, the Reformed Presbyterian Church Evangelical Synod joined with the PCA after the creation of the PCA in 1975. I believe it was in about 1980 or 81 that merger took place. But there were and still are some leftovers of the Reformed Scottish Reformed Presbyterians here in the United States, in North America. Well, the Reformed Presbytery then was allowed to be established in 1712. Queen Anne restored patronage to the Presbyterians. She was the sister, I believe, of Queen Mary, the sister of William III's wife. Anyway, she replaced William. When William died, she became the Queen of England, and she restored patronage to the Presbyterians so that, again, the church was supported by the government. It became a state church. A mainstream Presbyterian church was formed as a result of that, a rather interesting church in Scotland. These Presbyterians were happy to have some freedom, and so they had services that lasted about 3 hours. There was a lot of preaching. The moral law was very strictly enforced by the church. The state could be called in special cases. People who broke the law and wanted to get back into the church were called penitents. They had to wear gowns and sit in special stools in the church. Laws were made which required communion attendance. Communion became very infrequent because there were not enough ministers. And, of course, communion was a very laborious four-day affair. There was fasting on Thursday. On Friday and Saturday, there was preaching. On Sunday, there was communion. And then on Monday, there was thanksgiving. There were services of thanksgiving. So actually, it was a five-day affair. Pardon me, I said four-day affair. It was a five-day affair. When I counted those up as I read through them, I realized it was really quite a thing. And so it was very seldom that parishes were able to have communion. In fact, many of the members of parishes where there were no pastors attended communion in another parish. The preachers supplied the elements, and a great deal of attention was given to the form of the Lord's Supper. But there was still a very moderate spirit in Scotland, and slowly that took over as the Covenanters went out. John Witherspoon, for instance, who came to the North America and became one of the fathers of the United States through his activities in writing the Constitution, was one of those who was a very bitter critic of the moderates in Scotland. Well, let's look at some of these moderates, this spirit of moderating the strict Presbyterianism and the strict Reformed teaching of the church. William Roberts is the first one who comes to mind. He was a historian, and he was a leader of the moderates. And, of course, as a teacher, he had a great deal of influence, not only in the church, but especially in the universities, as is so often the case. And it didn't take a long time, as it has not taken a long time in other countries like Germany and the United States, for the moderates, or people we might call liberals, to begin to take over the colleges and eventually the church. Some of the factors in this were that a lot of the doctrines of Reformed teaching were not very well worked out in the life of the church. For example, regeneration and justification were worked out, but Many of the principles and details of the Christian life were left up to the local pastor. And some of these, of course, were so strict as to be odious. And, of course, it was easy for people to look for a little moderation in that kind of strictness. Another thing, of course, is that the Scottish at this time, the Presbyterians, did not separate the individual's relationship to God and the state from each other very well. And so there was some retreat from total reformation of the church. The people, they did not look to themselves, however, to work this out. They looked to the state. And so these were some factors which caused the people to moderate their thinking, because they were not able to put these things together, it seems to me, in a very biblical fashion. There was no church-world distinction. You had parish churches. And so you had believers and unbelievers coexisting in a given church. And that, too, of course, militates against the maintenance of a solid theology, because the unbelievers are not going to be happy with a strict theology. Not only that, the defenders of strict Reformed and Presbyterian theology were outnumbered because of all the things that had gone on through the Covenanter battles and through the pressure from the monarchy in England. The true Presbyterians and the truly Reformed leaders were in short supply. And so we shouldn't be surprised that it was not too long, for example, in 1718, that a book by Edward Fisher called The Marrow of Modern Divinity was written. It did push for the free offer of the gospel, which was one step in the right direction, but it was universalist, and the Orthodox rejected it as being universalist, and the moderates thought it didn't go far enough. But in any case, it's a demonstration that there was some movement in that direction. Finally, then, there was a secession from the church, the State Church of Scotland. It was called the Scottish Presbyterian Church. And the secession happened because the state was deciding who would become preachers in the various parishes in the localities. And finally, Ebenezer Erskine led a rebellion against that idea. The idea that no congregation should accept a preacher that it didn't trust was at the basis of this secession. The Assembly of Scotland, that is, the Assembly of the Church, rejected this in 1732, requiring the presbytery to install any minister called by the landowners and elders or the patron of that particular church. This was called the Barrier Act, and it was enforced by the General Assembly, even though the majority of the presbyteries did not approve it. It seems that the General Assembly was ruling rather autocratically at this point, and finally Ebenezer Erskine and three others were suspended in 1733 for striving against this. They were declared not to be ministers of the Church of Scotland. Well, what could they do? They founded the Associate Presbytery, popularly called the Secession. That was in 1733. They were invited back by the next General Assembly of the Church, which met at Perth, but they refused to come back. Churches were closed to them, so they had to build their own. Well, it's not surprising that since they had a little more authentic form of Christianity and some liberty, that the secession grew very rapidly from four pastors in 1733 to 40 years later, 200 congregations, often which owned their own building. Now, the division actually ended up with four different groups, and that raises the question when division is justified in churches. There's on the one extreme people who say you're never allowed to divide, and I suppose next come those who say you don't leave until you're kicked out. And there are those who seem to divide at the slightest pretense. Well, let's look at some of the things that happened in Scotland and see if we can't get some light on this idea of division, of when the church division, when division from the existing church is justifiable. In 1733, Erskine led the secession of presbyteries. They formed the Associate Presbytery. Well, they were divided on the issue of burghers and anti-burghers, they were called. That is, should burghers take the oath to defend the local church? That division came in 1799. Included is the question of whether an oath binds to Protestantism in general or also to the Church of Scotland. The anti-burghers were called the General Associate Synod, while the others were called the Associate Presbytery. And so you have a question of what is the relationship of church to state. And there were those who thought that they ought to divide on that issue. In fact, they ended up being divided on that issue because the anti-burghers said you should not take an oath to defend the local church because that belongs to the state church and that's not really a church that we as true Christians who are part of the associate presbytery ought to be involved in. Others thought that this was just a matter of state, of our relationship to the government, and thought it was all right. They were called the burghers. Well, again, the burghers were divided in 1799 and the anti-burghers in 1806 on the whole question of dropping the state church or not. This produced the old light burghers and the new light burghers, the old light anti-burghers, and the new light anti-burghers. It sounds like a war among Burger King and Hamburglar and that kind of thing. So we have to recognize that these kinds of questions arise, and we can get very heated discussions about them. From a perspective of a little different place in history, sometimes these things do not seem as important as they do to the people who are involved in them. And that's something I think that we have to deal with too. It's very important for us to be able to step aside and look at ourselves and say, is what we are fighting about or is what we are fighting for really worth fighting for? Well, the Associate Presbytery and the various results of the Associate Presbytery continued to grow so that the Free Presbyterians became a larger and larger group in Scotland. Well, I want to turn now to Thomas Gillespie, because here you have another separation from the Church of Scotland. Thomas Gillespie was a pastor who in 1752 refused to help install a forced pastor in a Church of Scotland. He refused to take part in forcing a pastor upon a congregation. When things came to a head, he finally left the Church of Scotland and formed the Relief Presbytery, as it was called, in 1761. Now, he didn't join the secession. He didn't join the Associate Presbytery because he believed in open communion. And so this, too, grew into another group of Presbyterian churches outside of the state church of Scotland, and it grew into a synod so that they had enough churches to form a synod which ruled by which they could rule over themselves. They, for instance, later on used George Whitefield as one of their evangelists in Scotland. I think we ought to realize that Whitefield did a great deal of preaching not only in North America, but especially in England and also in Scotland. So there's another group. Now, I think it's interesting to notice as we look at these groups that leave the church in Scotland that they are not very severely persecuted by the state church. The state church pretty much leaves them alone. Yes, there is dissatisfaction and unhappiness, but we don't see what happened with the Covenanters a century earlier. And I think that's perhaps because the Scottish government realized that the whole persecution of the Covenanters was a terrible thing for Scottish people. To be killing each other in the name of religion or religious differences was not the way that things ought to be. And so these people, we would say, got away with their leaving the state church. I think we have to recognize that during the same period in Holland, there was also the separation from the nominalism of the state church in Holland in 1834, a little bit later than this, I should say. There was a reaction to the state church in Holland, and those people were persecuted severely. Hendrik de Cock, who led the secession of the church out of the church of Holland, the Reformed Church of Holland, was severely persecuted. He was imprisoned. The troops were stationed in his house. He was fined, and all those kinds of things. Well, that kind of thing didn't happen here in the middle of the 18th century in Scotland, and I think it's important to recognize that. Another person that we want to talk about before we leave Scotland and go to the continent is John Glass, who lived from 1695 to 1793. He had the idea that primitive Christianity had long been left behind, and what he wanted to do was reestablish primitive Christianity as he understood it in Scotland. We see that kind of thing with some of the movements in the United States today. He wanted to return the church to what he considered to be first century practices. He wanted love feasts as he understood them from the Bible, and he wanted a weekly celebration of the Lord's Supper. He decided that education was unnecessary for pastors. Obviously, the disciples of Christ who became the apostles, several of them were uneducated men. And in fact, the Bible remarks on that. And simply being aware of Jesus and being a believer was enough, he thought, to make one capable of being a pastor. Alongside of Robert Glass's idea of return to first century Christianity as he understood it, was the rise of Sandemanianism, named after a man called Sandeman, S-A-N-D-E-M-A-N. He was actually the son-in-law of John Glass. And Robert Sandeman became the leader of Glass's church after Glass died. And he had the idea that faith is simple assent to the truth of the gospel. Didn't believe in commitment, repentance, or he certainly didn't believe in a conversion experience. I've talked earlier about the fact that the Puritans often got themselves in trouble because they would require a dramatic conversion experience. And we remember we said that that was a result of a kind of a rational approach, an experiential approach to Christianity in order to make Christianity more like a scientific thing. For example, science operates on the experimental method. Why shouldn't Christianity? And I pointed out that this was a problem among the New England Puritans as well as Puritans in England and Holland earlier on. The point is, though, that the reaction to this was Sandeman, who said that faith is simple assent to the truth of the gospel. For example, Michael Faraday, after whom the quantities of electricity in capacitors is named, the Farad, he was a great experimenter in electricity, was a member of Sandeman's church. Sandeman finally came to the U.S. He wasn't very successful in Europe, and he died just before the American Revolution. Nevertheless, his ideas still appear once in a while in reaction against conversionism, that true faith is simply assent to the truth. Well, we need to leave Scotland now and go to the continent. We have spent the first lectures of this course on England and Scotland, and we turn now to the continental Reformed theology and life in the 17th century. We're at that section in your outline and notes. Continental Reformed theology and life in the 19th century. And we want to begin in the Netherlands because, of course, the Netherlands was closely involved with England, because the Netherlands was a place where the 17th century was looked upon as the golden age. It was the age of a great deal of success on the part of the Dutch people in their mercantile pursuits, in their business, as well as in their trading pursuits around the world. The Dutch navy was large, and the Dutch peacetime maritime fleet of ships that engaged in trade all over the world was tremendous. And so there was a great deal of success in Holland. Well, there was also a great deal of success religiously. We know about the Synod of Dort, which met in 1618 and 19. We really want to go after the Synod of Dort with our discussion now, but we need to realize that there was a great deal of Orthodox Reformed Christianity in Holland during the 17th century, even though, as we will see, some problems arose and different currents came along. And one of the things we want to realize is that there was quite a bit of a relationship between England and Holland during these years. We all know about the Puritans who founded the Plymouth Colony, who came across the ocean on the Mayflower. They left from the harbor in Rotterdam, stopped in England on the way, but actually had provisioned their ship and gotten their ship in Holland, where they had spent some years in exile because of the persecution of dissenters in England. Well, after the Synod of Dort in the Netherlands, the Puritan influence, much of that kind of a back-and-forth thing from England, increased. A leader in that was William Teelink, T-E-E-L-I-N-C-K, who died in 1629. William Teelink was at first a lawyer in the southwest of the Netherlands, and he spent some time in England and became very impressed with the Puritans while he was there. Then early in the century, toward the the latter part of the 16th century, he returned to the Netherlands, and he was a preacher in Middelburg. He preached very much on personal faith. He said that Matthew 28:19 is still in effect, and therefore he encouraged the church to get involved in foreign missions. He wanted better Sabbath observance. He had disapproved of dancing and of theater and so on. And so we have to see, while there were perhaps some glitches in his theology, he was beginning to see something that was happening in the Netherlands, and that was that the Reformed commitment and the Reformed understanding of the gospel on the part of many people was becoming nominal. They kind of held to the doctrines without really understanding the authority of the Bible, and of course the doctrine itself then became less and less important. And he wanted a living, breathing, personal Christianity to be existent in the churches. And I believe that that's one of the great strengths of Puritanism, and that is something that we ought to be very concerned about too. It's very easy for churches to settle into a kind of moribund, that kind of a sleeping orthodoxy, and sometimes that's called dead orthodoxy. I would want to argue with that term and say if it's orthodoxy, if it's really orthodox, it can't be dead. On the other hand, there is a form of holding to reform things without having a real solid biblical understanding and a personal commitment to them. That's what Abraham Kuyper ran into a couple of hundred years later. Well, after the Synod of Dort, you not only had some of influence of Puritanism, but you had also the influence of an absolutely orthodox party. This party was led for quite a while by Gespertus Voetius. That's V-O-E-T-I-U-S, Gespertus Voetius. Voetius is a very famous Dutch theologian and church leader. He was at the Synod of Dort. He lived from 1589 to 1676. And after the Synod of Dort, he was one of the ultra-Orthodox leaders in the Reformed churches in the Netherlands. He was very strongly opposed to the Remonstrants at the Synod of Dort and served a very good purpose there. But after the Synod of Dort, and once the Canons of Dort were written, he seems to have fallen into the trap of trying to interpret everything in terms of election. And I think that's something that we have to be careful of, too. I believe that the Canons of Dort, as we call them, the doctrinal statement of the Synod of Dort, you need to understand that Dort produced a number of other things, such as a church order and so on. The actual acts of the Synod of Dort run to several volumes, but the brief statement of faith, what we call the 5 points of Calvinism, is very, very biblical and very carefully done, and it seems to me a very important progress in the doctrinal teaching of the church. Nevertheless, since that time, among Reformed and Presbyterian people, there has been a sense or a temptation, I guess I should have to say, to look at everything through the glasses of election and to think if we only hold to election, everything else will fall into place. And I think that that's a mistake because, first of all, election is not the great central teaching of the Bible. Certainly the sovereignty of God and election is an important aspect of the teaching of the Bible, and we don't want to deny that for a moment. But to try to look at everything through the eyes of election is to forget that God is the one who makes the decree, and that for man that decree is forever inscrutable. We cannot look into the decree of election. We cannot look into that and know that I'm elect that way. We see the evidence of election in the faith and the lives that we live, and so we become more and more sure that we are among the elect as we live from day to day and year to year as Christians. But we do not look into the decree that God has made. The decree of election is, as I say, the hidden decree of God. We talk about the secret will of God, and that election is certainly a part of that secret will of God. And yet, Voetius and others try to interpret everything in terms of election. And I believe that's why you get things like hyper-Calvinism, where you get the idea that we can determine who is elect and who is not elect, and so on. Well, after the Synod of Dort, Voetius did not want to change anything. He was a professor at Utrecht, and he he was influenced somewhat by Tailing's ideas, but he was careful not to be anti-church, which was a problem that arose with Tailing and his Puritanism, because, of course, the Puritanism that came from England was a dissenter Puritanism, and with that dissension came to Holland the idea that perhaps there should be some dissension from the state church there. Now, not to say that we are in favor of state churches, but to realize that we cannot oppose that which is already established without raising some questions of our own, that we need to have a better answer. Well, anyway, Fruitius was a very orthodox theologian, had a great deal of usefulness with respect to that, and yet tended to want to see everything through the eyes of the Acts of the Synod of Dort. He saw the danger of Descartes, the philosopher, who was a rationalist, and he opposed him thoroughly. He also was a professor at Utrecht, in the theological college at Utrecht. And finally, he ran into a great deal of opposition with Johannes Coxeus. Now, this is a very important period in the history of the Dutch Church, because Fruitius and Coxeus became leaders of two groups which represent two aspects of Reformed Christianity, or two principles and themes of Reformed Christianity, which when put together are very healthy, but which when separated from each other are unhealthy. So we need to investigate a bit Johannes Coxeus. That's C-O-C-C-E-I-U-S, but it's pronounced Coxeus, who lived from 1603 to 1669. Coxeus was originally from Bremen in Germany, where he received a moderate Reformed upbringing among the German Reformed people there. He did some studies in Holland and became a professor at Franeker, at one of the schools of theology in Holland. Later on, in 1650, he became a professor at Leiden, where he was a professor of theology. Now, Coxeus's theology is characterized by two particular ideas. One is a strong basis in the Bible. The authority for what we teach and believe comes directly from the Bible, Coxeus taught. This was something that got him into conflict with Fruitius, who almost seems to have put the creeds on the same level as the Bible. Now we'll have to stop at that point and begin with our next lecture to talk more about this conflict.
This lecture is copyrighted by Reformation Christian Ministries, the parent organization of Reformation International Theological Seminary and Reformation International College. This audio lecture is protected under international copyright law and is not to be copied, distributed, sold, or used commercially without the specific written permission of Reformation Christian Ministries. You may contact Reformation Christian Ministries through our website at www.reformation.edu. Reformation is spelled R-E-F-O-R-M-A-T-I-O-N. By email, you can also contact us at president@reformation.edu. By phone in the U.S., you can reach us at 772-571-8030. By fax in the U.S., you can reach us at 772-571-8010. Or by writing to Reformation Christian Ministries, 13950 122 Street, Fellsmere, Florida, 32948 in the USA.